Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com. This is an excerpt from a podcast for which I'm a tremendous fan of, Scald by Aubrey Sitterson. It takes you through an amazing fantasy story as narrated by the author. Let's take a listen right now.
Xylan awoke, howling, caught in a blinding flash of light. With that searing whiteness still impeding his vision, he gnashed his bestial teeth and lashed out with his fur-covered paws, desperate to tear skin, to rend flesh, to crack bones, to revel in grim, bloody mortality. And laugh. Lie to me? Deceive me? He cackled and snarled at the old wizard, the one who had put a stop to his attack before sending him careening into slumber. With his vision slowly returning, Xylan scrambled to his feet. I like a trick, but I love a joke. Come closer, let me tell you. But as he began to make sense of his surroundings, the godless monk realized that the wizard, the bald-headed old man with the distinctive purple birthmark, was nowhere to be found. In fact, no one was anywhere to be found. Nothing was to be found there, as Xylan found himself in a dim, barren, lifeless tundra, dimly lit by a quickly setting sun. For the first time since he transformed, since he devolved, since he changed, Xylan slowed. He stopped. He looked down and took stock of himself. He gazed down at his hands. No, at his paws, tipped with short, blunt, black claws, claws that flexed and quivered as he stared at them, claws that wanted to be out, to be free, to sink into flesh and tear, to carve out red gashes, gushing rivers of gore, to give rise to the immortal, timeless joke of... No. Xylan closed his eyes, and he shook his head, desperate to blot out the images of rushing blood and pumping viscera that filled his mind. He stood for a moment, motionless, silent, but his attention was divided by that sound, that horrible giggling, sadism fighting for attention with masochism, driven to distraction by that laugh. With horror creeping across his consciousness, he realized the truth. It was his laugh.
We're listening to Scald, which is a very epic podcast in the truest sense, because not just the story content of what goes on there, the way that it's produced by our guest and what he's doing. And Justin singled him out to have him on. We had him Weird Things and After Things. And it's so excited to have you here, Aubrey, because...
Hey, thanks for having me, man.
You know, we deal with... By the way, I'm Andrew Main, joined by, of course, Brian Brushwood.
Yo, I'm sorry. I'm blown away. I'm clearly not here in these United States.
No, Justin Robert Young.
Hello.
And what excites me about this is that you're playing with mediums in their own way. You know, you've created something very cool that's this high fantasy, I guess we'd call it, and the way you're producing, the way you do it's really cool, and it's something new that's, you know, kind of hard for people to sort of process in some ways. Obviously, there have been stories told narratively like this, but the way you do it and how you're doing it is very cool, and it's why you're perfect for this to come be here.
Well, thanks, man. I'm thrilled. Thank you again for having me. Scald's something I'm super proud of. Justin mentioned it on the Weird Things podcast, but I do everyone in one take, and that's kind of very much part. And you touched on this a little bit, that it's meant to be a kind of continuation or a a new way to introduce a really old, like the oldest form of storytelling, right? Mm-hmm. Which is just oral storytelling, just sitting right down and telling somebody a story. And it's some of my favorite stuff. Just, you know, one of my favorite things to do is just sit down in a dark bar with somebody who's really interesting and let them tell me a thing, right? and so that's what Scald's supposed to be. Scald is supposed to be sitting around the campfire, hearing the story. It's supposed, in a Scald, that term, it's basically just a Scandinavian bard. Right. These are the guys who hung out in the courts of the kings and jarls and talking about big mythical heroes.
I'm going to interrupt you back up for a second. When you say, okay, so are you reading from a script when you do this?
Well, yeah. So I write every episode. And so I write a new episode every week and then I read it. Right. But it's written. It's interesting. And so I have the prose stuff available and I put it up because I know that not everybody wants to listen to something. But truthfully, it's written to be heard, not read. So there are a lot of little tricks and things that I do because having listened to a lot of audiobooks, I struggle with them because my mind wanders and all of a sudden I come back in and I have no idea what's going on and I find myself rewinding constantly. And that might just be me being bad at listening to it.
No, as a audiobook evangelist who keeps handing out and buying audiobooks for other people and hearing back from them like, yeah, you know, I guess I'm just not an audiobook person. I just tune out. And I was like, how could you do that? That's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, so for me, the struggle is that I don't know, my mind wanders. If I'm driving and I'm listening to this thing, I start thinking about something else. And when I'm reading a book, I like to go back and reread passages if my mind wanders or if I just like the way it sounds. So, mm-hmm. you know, one of the things I do with Scald to try and combat that is I do a lot of repetition. And so I've heard from people that it makes for kind of a weird prose read, but actually hearing it, it's helpful because the repetition allows you to kind of zone out and come back in, but it also allows me to add extra emphasis to whatever it is that I'm repeating.
You know, that's an interesting note because as a writer in the written word, you avoid reusing a word. You want to avoid, if I say, I went to the window and I looked out and I saw nothing, so I stood back from the window and went to the other side of the room, you would avoid using window twice so close to each other. But if I was, you know, doing a narration of that, I went to the window and I looked outside and I saw nothing. So I pushed away from the window and went over somewhere else. You have that downturn.
The one that you guys just played, I used the word dim, or I used dimly and then dim in, like, I don't know, like five words separated from each other. And reading it, that looks lousy. But when you say it, you know, it's this it was dimly lit by the sun and that dim light or whatever, you know, like, so it's a way to further play with language.
Because you add that emphasis to touch
exactly
back.
That you're not able to do with prose. And so that was – when I first started it, I made a huge list – or I made two lists, right? One of all the stuff that I'm going to lose by doing it primarily audio-based, right? That's going to be more difficult for people to pick up on. And then I made a separate list of all the pluses, right? All the stuff that I gain. And what it is just, you know, it's inflection, it's tone, it's speed. You know, there are things that, like, I can say it, but if I say it quickly, it doesn't register with you just as much. So it's something that's seated, but maybe not seated as hard as it would have been if it was just written. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and to give a little bit of context, like explain to folks some of your pedigree. Like this is the kind of story that had the option to go through the traditional comic book publication avenues, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess I could have. I used to edit comic books at Marvel. I edited Walking Dead and Invincible for Robert Kirkman, Kick-Ass, a few other things on the side as well. And I've written comics as well, short stories at Marvel and DC and Image and Viz. And so, yeah, I'm a comic book guy and I love doing comic books. And one of the big things I like about it is the freedom to do whatever you want because you don't have a special effects budget, right? Because it's just being drawn, as well as the serialized nature of it. And I chose to do it this way initially because – it was something I could do totally by myself and I wouldn't have to rely on anybody else, artists flaking out or anything like that. But then once I made that decision, I realized that there was going to kind of be a whole host of challenges and also benefits from doing it like this. And so that's where the list came from.
So let's get back to where you came from with the editing of comic books. When, you know, we've talked previously, there is a very, the comic book world is kind of insular and provincial. And it is, like, at times hard to kind of get into a system where you can write your own story with the kind of freedom that you are doing with Scald. How much of those restrictions kind of brought you to the product that we just heard?
I'm sorry. How much of like being
how much of how hard it is to make the a totally freeform comic book that that does exactly what you want, especially even from your perspective as an editor of comic books. How hard is that to get made?
Well, you know, it depends. You know, if you are someone who is a talented writer and artist, it's super easy because you just sit down and do it and you post it up on the internet. And that's sort of where my hurdle was, which is that I'm not an artist. and try as I might, I can't do it. I can't do justice to the stories that I want to tell with my limited artistic capabilities. And so for me, it was very difficult because I would either need to get the money together to pay someone to do it. I would need to find someone who's willing to do it on spec. I just dropped out again, didn't I?
Well, we connect that. I think that is a very, very good point about sometimes we want to be in a medium, but that medium is collaborative and we're not in a position to really have the kind of collaborators we want to work with. And the more you can do on your own, the further you can move that football, the better
Scald
off
you're
going to be.
Scald at the podcast that Skype does not want you to hear.
There we go.
Skype, tell you what you can listen to with your free time. Don't let them do it.
Promo.
So what we were talking about is the differences between a collaborative environment versus going on your own. And it seems to me like there's a couple of different periods as people develop artistically. Early on, it's great to go on your own because nobody could tell you stop. There are times that it's great to collaborate with other people and that you're able to make something bigger than yourself. But then, Night Attack and Cord Killers being shining examples to it, you know, you reach a point where it's like, you know, it'd be great as if we were doing this on our own, and you end up going back to it again.
I with my own experience in writing is, you know, there's the next Jessica Blackwood book with Harper Collins. It's going to be a year before that comes out. That book's, I'm guaranteeing, the first draft, this is done. That has been done for several months. That's going to take a year for that book to go from, you know, from there to end up on a bookshelf versus, you know, I sit down and I finish a book a couple weeks ago and I write down a bunch of notes on how I make it. I put out a book called How to Write a Novella in 24 Hours. And then I take that novella and I spend a couple weeks polishing after working on other stuff and I put out that novella, and you can have that both worlds. And I love what Aubrey's doing here and doing this serialized, continuized thing that is a podcast. Is it an audiobook too? Do you make let people buy?
I have not. I've actually Justin has actually urged me to do it. Here's the thing though, and I'll be honest with you. The reason I haven't done it, and I told Justin this as well, is I've gotten a lot better at doing them as I've gone on. And so I go back and listen to those earlier episodes, and you guys ask me, you're like, oh, should we put on the first one? I was like, no, because it suffers by comparison to the more recent ones.
So I
would want to go – before I put anything together as an audiobook, I would want to go back and re-record everything, which I just don't have time for.
Everything.
No, I understand. We're not going to berate you, but like, you should do this. You're doing a lot. So don't feel like we're
Worry. Don't. I've berated him plenty.
I was about to say, dude, I will join the beration train if that's it. It's like if there's somebody out there who wants to give you money, figure out a way to let them
for
give
sure.
you money.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's on the list. But yeah, I'm a busy beaver right now, man. I do Scald, and I also do a wrestling podcast that Justin's actually been on a couple times.
I guess to my point was just to say that what you have here though is great because it is a that single work can function as a podcast. You're putting it out in a ebook format. Mm-hmm. You have ideas for how you do a printed format, and then it can be a audio book, which I'm sure there are a lot of people that want to do that. And you can either try to create a bunch of different works going different directions, but you have this. How many hours of this thing are there now?
Oh Christ! If somebody can help me with the math. I mean, like each one's about about 16 hours.
Wow.
Okay.
A novel length audiobook you have.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I've got a ton of stuff, and it's that's one of the things that's been most nerve-wracking about it, but also great, which is that it's a grind, man. It started off at about 20 minutes each episode. Now they're up to almost 40. And I write 40 minutes of new content every single week and also have to perform it in one take. So it is grueling. It's really, really brutal, but it's actually been a really great kind of serialized storytelling boot camp. You know, so I've worked in comics since 2004 in one fashion or another. So it's not like I'm unfamiliar with serialized storytelling and the tropes and limitations and things like that. But actually having to sit down and do it every single week. And sometimes it's, you know, you – write yourself the cliff that you're going to jump off of before you know how you're going to land. But that's kind of what's thrilling about it, right? Is you seed things, and it's I've learned an immense amount from doing it.
So one of the things that you know we talked about was the fact, as you touched on, that you record all of this in one take. As somebody who has recorded audiobooks, long form audio content, I find this to be at its most charitable, an act of self harm.
Yeah, it's psychotic.
Why do you want to punish yourself?
I'll tell you, man. The answer is really simple. I started doing it, and I started doing it in one take because the whole idea was that this is oral storytelling. It's not a – and I in some of the intros, I actually draw this distinction. I say, listen, this is not an audiobook, right? This is not something that I wrote for as a novel, and then it's recorded. It's also not a radio serial. You know, it's not wacky voices and sound effects and music cues and different actors and things like that. This is an oral story. Right. And it's done in the fashion of Scandinavian bards named Skalds. Those guys, what they did, they didn't get multiple takes. Right. It was a whole. Right. They didn't build a thing piecemeal and then put it all together. Right. They created a full story. And so doing it that way, I think, brings an integrity to the work that it's like added value to me. So, you know, it's something to help set it apart. And it's something that I'll be honest with you. It was brutal at first. Like the first couple months, I thought, like, what have I done to myself? Like, how do I, like after having made such a big deal out of the fact that I do it in one flawless take, and like one of the selling points for it. After making such a big deal, like, how do I walk this back and start editing it together? But
nobody would know. You can literally just hit pause, roll it back, and start recording again.
Yeah, but I mean, I think you'd be able to tell. I mean, because there's been times where, like, there was something one time my computer – so all this terrible stuff happens, right? Like, the guy next door starts weed whacking. My dog barks. Sometimes my computer would, like, I don't know, it started backing up and it just skipped a little bit, right? So I had this amazing take of an episode, but right in the middle, and it just – like, record skipping right in the middle. And so I thought, okay, well, if I cut that out and maybe I can just re-record this word, and I tried it, and it messes – and maybe I'm just – hearing stuff that's not there. It messes up the flow. It really does. It doesn't feel like a full thing anymore.
How did you – I would imagine that the ancient Skalds had routines that they would go into to compensate for the fact that a log exploded or a wench was stolen or whatever. I would imagine that they have ways to keep everyone's interest but acknowledge the heckler or whatever and keep everything on the rails. What have you come up with? Because – I refuse to believe that you do all 16 hours without a single misspeaking moment.
Oh, well, I stop and I start over again if I do.
Yeah. No, he does. He does it over. So he's
I do it again. I mean, if I'm 35 minutes in, before a 40 minute episode, and the dog barks, I stop. I go now, get a glass of water and I start over again.
But in my mind, and this is just me, trying to be overly self-deprecating, I just assume I would instantly acknowledge the dog bark and be like, what do you expect? I'm here recording this all by myself. So anyway, and then go back to it. But you
it's
don't
like
do
the
any
Kevin
of that.
Kevin Smith podcast. Shaggy!
Yeah.
Shaggy! Shaggy!
I could. I mean, yeah, I think it would be a different vibe. You know, what I do with Skald is I really do want it to feel immersive. Right. Like, and I want people to feel like they're in that world. And so I don't want to break. I have an intro and I have an outro, but I don't break the fourth wall other than that.
Wow. That's amazing, because to me, that would be the way I would sell this is have the beginning of every episode. I mean, it's not to reduce your podcast to a gimmick, because I know it's an epic story, but that's a hell of a gimmick. If you want to get somebody to listen to the first episode is explain. Also, it's all done in one take.
For sure. I mean, and that's I mentioned it at the top of every episode for that exact reason. It's something I'm super proud of. And it's not, there are a lot of – we're kind of in a renaissance right now of people doing these serialized podcasts, right? And most of them, though, are these radio serial type things. And most of them are kind of pieced together. And so this is something that sets Skald apart. It's not a cast of people. It's just me. I write it. I perform it. And it's one go.
Man.
I have a question for you, sir.
Yes, sir.
Your very, very popular
I believe
Straight Shoot.
What's that?
It's called Straight Shoot.
Yeah. The quote, the world's smartest wrestling show. On your Patreon, you start there, you have a dollar level, and you move on up. for Scald, you start at, was it like $6? What was your thinking on how you were pricing your different Patreon levels?
Sure. You know, the Straight Shoot Patreon is much more popular than the Scald Patreon. And Straight Shoot's been around longer. And I started with more of a baked-in wrestling audience because I had worked – prior to this, I had worked at both 2K and THQ working on the WWE video games. Wow. So I had an audience that was ready to consume Straight Shoot. And so as Straight Shoot has grown, I've added more reward tiers. Truthfully, the real answer, though, is it's two-part. One is that I don't have as much swag and stuff to give away with Scald as I do with Straight Shoot. So it's harder for me to find those reward tiers. And also it's kind of just a little bit of trial and error and finding out what works. And it's a very different audience than the Straight Shoot audience. And so I've seen people talk about best practices for Patreon and say completely opposite things. Some people say, you know, you want a ton of reward tiers so that you can hit everybody, right? And if, you know, if somebody's given $2, they say, oh, well, no, I may as well give $3. But I've seen other people say, no, you want to limit it so that and to just the big rewards and have them separated so that it doesn't overwhelm and confuse people when they look at it. So some of it's trial and error, and some of it's just me not having as many things to give away for Scald.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. Yeah, I'm very much a novice in this area compared to, you know, Brian and Justin and some of the other people that are really actively involved in there. And you know, you look at. You can study a lot about Kickstarter, but as we've been watching through Justin's experience with Kickstarter, it's a great way to launch a business. But if that is your entire business model onto itself with Kickstarter, get ready to break out the credit cards and, you know,
well, planning. Which, by the way, you recently saw, you know, Roman Mars launched Radiotopia, the folks who do the 99% Invisible podcast, and there was the big deal about having a Kickstarter, and they blew the doors off. It was one of the biggest Kickstarters of all time. And then, sure enough, less than a year later, they're all like, it's another Kickstarter, because we want to do even more, And then, very quickly, they figured out, they're like, yeah, this is not sustainable. We can't keep doing Kickstarters, and now they're big drive is about people signing up to be recurring donors, and they figured out rewards that are specific to people who are kind of ongoing members in their party.
Well, another big thing for me comparing Kickstarter to Patreon, and this is one of the things I really like about Patreon, is and this is anecdotal evidence for sure. It probably has a lot to do with the type of Kickstarters that I've contributed to, but I've never contributed to a Kickstarter that did not disappoint me in some profound way.
Wow.
Whether it's things not happening, whether it's things not happening on time, whether them being lousy when they got there, whether it's me later reading reports of collaborators not getting what they were promised. You know, I am always disappointed. And the reason you're disappointed by Kickstarter so often is because there's no accountability on any side, right? You just give people this money and fingers crossed, hopefully this thing happens. Patreon is something totally, totally different. Because when somebody has a Patreon set up and they're asking you for money, they're not saying, give me money so I can do this thing. They're saying, listen, I'm already doing this thing. You know what you're getting. Please give me what it's worth. So I think it's a much more honest way to interact with consumers, truthfully.
Yeah. Well, and it's also, it is less emotional in a good way, Patreon. You know, like it is more realistically emotional. Kickstarter is a tremendous, like, oh no, we're going to make the dream happen, right? Like, so you invest so much emotionally into people hitting goals, people making this thing, you know, the idea of what it's going to be when I get it. There's a lot of emotional investment. Patreon is like, oh no, well, I'm going to give this to somebody, or like, you know, let's say I'm leaving the job. So it's like, oh, I'm going to give more to Justin. Justin will be able to create more and take more time and focus on the podcast. It's a realistic emotional exchange. Money for thing. And that's it. Whereas Kickstarter is like you, for your disappointment and all these things, a lot of it comes from the fact that you have such high expectations that this is going to happen, or that things that are even in big, gigantic products, fairly routine, like delays, is now like, oh, yeah, but oh, it feels weirder that, you know, like I don't get this thing now because I put in money and now I invested in it. Now they didn't just break the general promise of, well, this video game now is going to come out in 2016 instead of 2015, but a very specific promise to me that I backed up with my heart. Money.
Well, and you should feel that way, I think. Yeah. You know, like I think people are right to be upset about it when stuff, when people, because it's they failed, right? Like they made a promise to you that they were going to do things, and then they just flat out didn't. And that wouldn't fly in an actual, like, normal business if your investors gave you these, like, money to produce a comic book or whatever, and then you just didn't. That wouldn't fly there, but there's no, again, there's no accountability on Kickstarter.
My opinion on how strident I'm going to be on this will completely depend on whether or not the cards get off the line this week from our printer and our rewards get out before Christmas, shit, like we promised.
I mean this about everybody but Justin. You should give Justin a break.
To that point, Justin, it's funny because we're gearing up for our next big release, and it is a big release. It is the biggest release, the biggest bet we've made all year on Scam Stuff, and it kills me that we're gonna go. We're gonna announce, and we have it in stock. It's ready to go, but we're gonna announce it on Friday. And I have to do it knowing that there are still people who ordered 3 weeks ago the pre-order, and due to a million delays that weren't my fault and couldn't be projected, and, you know, promises, you know, we thought we had a reasonable timeline based on a million different things. There are going to be people who didn't get the previous big release, and it's so. I mean, it's not fun for the person who's placed in that position, but of course, that's the cost of doing your thing.
Yeah, it's I'll tell you, I've never done a Kickstarter. And the reason why is I sat down and I was planning to, a friend of mine, we're going to work together and we're going to Kickstarter a comic book, right? And we're going to get enough money that he was going to draw it and color it. And so his part of it was going to be much more time intensive. And so we need to get him money to be able to afford to spend all day, every day working on this comic book. And, you know, he gave me a really, really conservative estimate for how much money he would need. And he was, you know, not taking a big page rate or anything. And then I talked to a bunch of friends of mine who had successfully kickstarted comic books before, and talked to them about what rewards work, you know, how not to lose your shirt on shipping, all of this stuff, right? And then I made a big budget and I worked it out, and I realized that I was going to have to kickstart twice as much money as I actually needed.
Yeah.
Just to make the moonshine stickers and the t-shirts and then also just to ship it places. And I was like, this is psychotic. I'm not doing this. And it becomes a full-time job too.
I think that a lot of Kickstarters though do overdo it in a lot of those sort of giveaways and stuff. Cause like, I just want the thing. I just want the thing, you know, and you know, there are ways to figure out a tier, and you know, there are smarter ways to do it. And I see a lot of people spend so much money on swag. I'm like, I get like, oh, we got to send you swag. I don't care. I gave you 100 because I really liked the idea or whatever. And I think that's one of the problems. And it's also, I think, comes from sometimes an insecurity in the product. But, you know, another failing point of our point of failure, rather, for Kickstarter stuff is like you have this where one person says, yeah, I can do it. And then the unsaid asterisk is, yeah, if I don't have this job, if I still don't have a job by then, and then you're like, hey, we're funded. And they're like, yeah, you know, that's great. But, you know, I got this. And you're like, you know, that's why working with collaborators and other people is nobody will ever have as much skin in the game as you do. And if we're online and we're creating stuff, we're pretty flaky to begin with. Let's be honest.
Well, and you've seen that a million different times in a million different ways. You know, I think that was a similar story to the Yogg's Cast guys, where they were like, hey, look, we have a passionate fan base. We're going to build a game. We've talked to this person. They said they could build a game for us. we have raised a bunch of money. Turns out these guys are flakes and they overpromised. And now we are just out of it because we kept feeding money into them and they kept not doing things. And so sorry for your money not giving you anything what you wanted. But we're going to just put our heads in the sand and pretend we're dead.
Yeah, and, I mean, to walk back a little bit from my stridency earlier, you know, but there are degrees, right? Like when I talk about not getting things on time, I'm talking about the animated short Kickstarter that I contributed to 3 years ago and still has not surfaced, right? I'm not talking about like a couple weeks here and there because shipping delays, I totally get it. But, you know, there is a kind of mentality with a lot of Kickstarters, I think, and people who do them, that once they get that money, it's found money, and they just, you know, I'm the artist and I do whatever I want. You know, and you were talking about like people online, like creating content, being flaky. Like, I try really hard not to be, because I treat it like a business. Like, this is my business, and if you're giving me money, I owe you at least what I promised you, at least, you know?
Yeah.
I I come from, you know, my background of writing magic books and doing that, and I knew of there were a couple times where you'd see people who would with names would say, oh, you know what, I'm going to do that, and they would announce a product, they would pre-sell the product, and then delay, and ruin themselves, ruin their reputations, their ability to be able to sell stuff. And my attitude was always like, yeah, I'll pre-sell it when it's done. You know, I'll finish a thing, I'll have it ready, I'll have my quotes back for my printers or my DVD replicators, I'll have this sucker ready to go, press send, you know, and if the thing I'm looking for is like, yeah, I want enough money to cover the print thing so I don't have to put it on my credit card, maybe I'd do a pre-sell. But other than that, you know, but this mentality of people who are like, well, let's do a Kickstarter and get it funded and then we'll be impassioned to go do it is horrible. You're a horrible human being if that's your attitude.
It is a cardinal sin. It was something that we focused on a lot about with the contender, was just like, keep your promises. And that's why it matters to us. And it's like, yeah, is it in the grand scheme of things, would it be the worst thing in the world if the contender wasn't to Kickstarter people by Christmas? I don't know how many people, until we introduce the new deals we have coming up when we launch the site, are going to be really excited about having the contender on Christmas. But we made the promise, and it is important to us and important to our reputation for the next time that we want to do a Kickstarter, because like, this is doing a card game. It requires a tremendous amount of capital. You know, it requires stuff to go in and get it done, you know, but we need to make sure that promise is kept, because if it's not, you're really just doing damage to yourself.
Well, I guess that's the big question is, how many players are in the Kickstarter game for a single time cash out versus people looking to build a reputation as somebody that that's the whole thing that keeps commerce working, is you have one transaction and you hope it goes well so that you get to have more and more and more.
Well, you did that masterfully. Now, were you Indiegogo or you Kickstarter, Brian?
It was Indiegogo, because Kickstarter does not allow you to start a business through their platform. It has to be a physical product that you push or an artistic product.
Oh, they do.
What's that?
Yeah. At the time, they didn't. Now they've relaxed.
No kidding, jerks.
My hunch is that most people who go to Kickstarter want to do the latter, right? They do. They don't want to just take the money and run. Like, they're not trying to be fraudulent with people, but I think they just don't have the discipline or the knowledge or the experience or the time or some combination of the above to actually do it. You know, because again, there's just no accountability. There's no one holding their feet to the fire. Whereas again, with something like Patreon, and this is why it's so excellent, if you guys get a bunch of Patreon donations and then start to rest on your laurels, the next month, that Patreon number ain't going to be looking so good.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they're also, they serve different things really well. And you people who are trying to do podcasts realize that Kickstarter was a very poor medium for that, because you're constantly trying to, and now let me start this next run. You sound like a bad local PBS trying to constantly fundraise for Patreon. You know, you have a little bit of that in every episode, but you know, but if you're trying to do a specific physical one-time product, Kickstarter's wonderful. And
do your listeners complain when you guys plug Patreon?
Well, no, because it's almost always couched in a thanking. A remind, if you're somebody who pays, then you know you're thrilled that we're thanking you. If you're somebody who doesn't pay, you know you're pretty happy to be reminded that other suckers are paying for this.
I put my I don't get it with Scald, but I do get it with Straight Shoot, my wrestling show. I think that's a big part of that is because I put it on YouTube and people will stumble across it via search and keywords and things like that. And they hear me plugging Patreon, and there's so much free content. There's so much like wrestling chit chat content on YouTube that people are kind of taken aback. But a friend of mine who works in, he's a fan, he's a listener, and he sent me an unsolicited email full of advice about fundraising, because that's what he does for a living. And he told me, listen, I know people complain and they piss and moan about you plugging your Patreon and saying you do it too much or you're too hard or whatever. He said, here's the thing. If there are people who already pledged, they understand, because if you don't plug it, then they don't know about it. And if there are people who aren't pledging and they've decided they don't want to pledge, well, they're not really your audience anyways. Screw them. They're not going to pledge no matter – like they're not going to – like if you don't plug it, they're not going to magically start pledging because you didn't plug it.
Right. Right.
So –
No,
it's a weird mentality. It's like a weird thing. Like, it's a weird thing to have to like let roll off your back all the time. These people complaining that you're asking for money, but it's just kind of the nature of creating content on the web in 2015.
I mean, I think that's also just that is a very unfortunate and weird part of the YouTube culture, is this idea, you know, about like e-begging, right? like that was a thing that was a very big part of like, hey, I like doing these, but I would also like to make it my job. So if you would like to, if you agree with me, here's my PayPal. You know, if you'd right. like to PayPal me money, then you can PayPal me money. And that was looked down upon as like, oh no, this is eBay. Well, I work a job at Arby's and right. you know, I would love to do it too. Why don't you give me money? Because the relatability of internet content kind of ran headlong into this self-loathing complex of people who don't, you know, follow their, you know, who don't put the time and effort into creating the content that they want to do. Now, Patreon has done a great job of normalizing it. And it's so funny that it started out very much as a YouTube. It was, you know, founded by YouTube people and had a certain degree of success. And then wound up getting into podcasts where people did, where that culture, podcast culture, did not have a problem with people monetizing or people getting money. And all of a sudden it kind of grew. And it's like, and now that it's a name, people are like, oh, okay, yeah, this isn't eBay.
I'm so thrilled whenever I see anyone go like set up a Patreon campaign because it does exactly what you're talking about. It normalizes it. Because before, yep. like, so I've been using Patreon for, I don't know, since like early 2014, right? And at the time, nobody knew what it was, right? And it was really difficult to educate people that they should go to this site, that they should put their credit card in, they should set up an account. But the more things that are on there, the easier that hurdle is to clear of actually going over to Patreon and giving some money to somebody.
Absolutely. It was funny. Like Neshcom pointed out in the chat room, says Indiegogo still sounds sketchy. I agree. Like Indiegogo, Brian's, you know, is an outlier where he had a specific case where it was not going to work on Kickstarter. But I've seen a lot of people, they go like, yeah, we don't like the rules on Kickstarter, so give us our money over there on Indiegogo. And like my impression of Indiegogo is like, oh, it's going to be half-baked. Versus, you know, Patreon, as you say, the more people use it, the more people understand it. And I'm explaining this to people all the time, but man, like, it's funny. Like, I put a tweet out and I said, if you love something, set it free, then go to Amazon or Goodreads and write a blurb about it. And then I put hashtag hint. And I get one guy who's like, really begging for reviews. And I'm like, well, I didn't say my book. And two, and I started this exchange. I said, you know, it's part of promotions. Like, you don't need to do that. And I looked, the guy's got 4 subscribers to his YouTube channel.
Oh.
4 subscribers. And I'm like, please give me more advice on how I can run this thing like you are. And, you know, it's that fear that when do we push it too much? Like every time, I used to be every time I sent out an email and I'd see the unsubscribes, I took every single one personally. But then I thought about all the times I unsubscribe from stuff because I just don't have time to look at it or it's not really my thing. And it's not like, I almost want to send like, hey, you're doing great, but I'm not into this thing right now, you know? And I realized if I'm not getting unsubscribes, I'm not doing enough to promote. And you have to certainly, you know, I've never had another creator tell me, you're pushing too much.
Right.
You know, I never had a successful creator tell me that.
This stupid sense of false modesty of like, oh, well, don't promote your stuff and don't retweet good reviews and blah, blah, blah. No, that's what is social media for if not telling people how great you are? That's the only reason it exists is to market yourself
you get
as a brand.
This, you, there are people who have a very naive idea on how things work or whatever. Like, and I go like, well, actors don't do it. I'm like, well, I can show you a bunch of actors sitting over there at Starbucks waiting for the phone to ring because nobody knows who they are when you don't see them on CSI. And I'm sure as hell positive you're not supporting them.
Well, and if you're looking at successful actors, like really successful actors, they don't need to do it. Well, right? they've got enough work coming in. They don't have to hustle in the same way.
I mean, the problem is the real successful actors had a period where they had to work out some kind of clever story of self-promotion or a way to get their roommate to call pretending to be a Hollywood executive to blah, 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 blah. I mean, the truth is all these folks who are
super – and they're paying – just to interrupt you, it's like, and they're paying publicists hundreds of thousands of dollars a month to keep their name out there and to promote them and to do this that you're not even aware of, like, exactly. Wait, why did this item end up on TMZ? Right. Why did this end up in People magazine? You know, why was this there?
And the problem is once they get over the hump and once they are successful, it is in their best interest. The game theory says now you pretend that you never participated in any of that and you sell this BS narrative that you were discovered and it was your talent that got you to the top and then everyone will agree with it. This is the first time that we're watching everything happen transparently where everybody can track. They can see like, oh, here he is self-promoting himself. here he is, you know, making up this clever campaign to, you know, get people to leave reviews. And now here he is as a bestseller author, you know?
I mean, I have had more people that I would think to be important to me as listeners, viewers, readers, right, that have said, why don't you tell me that this thing is happening? I didn't know that this thing was happening. I didn't know that you had, a political podcast, or you had Night Attack, or that, like, you know, Brian and I left a network and changed the name of the show, and there was nary but the normal 6 days between episodes of the old thing and the new thing, and still we get people saying, oh, wow, I didn't know that you guys had stayed together after NSFW show, despite the fact that the last episode of NSFW show, we said we're doing a new show called Night Attack. It'll be here, and here is where you can go ahead and sign up to the RSS feed or subscribe on iTunes. You know, it is more important that you let qualified audience know in the mediums in which they pay attention to that something is happening than it is for somebody to just be like, oh, wow, they sure are letting everybody know about that.
Yeah, man. There was this one kind of biting tweet from Sarah Silverman, and it was one of those things that kind of cut me to the quick, where she says, "Dear celebrities who retweet nice things people say about you, why do you do that?" And it was just sort of like, oh, that is what celebrities do, and it is tacky and whatever. But then it's like, I'm overwhelmed with this, like, because we have to, it's the only way we keep food on the table.
She, who has crazy successful career already, start telling other people, oh, no, you shouldn't be doing this stuff. I mean, and the reason to answer her question, it's, oh, well, because it teaches people that, first of all, it lets everybody know that people out there think you're great. And also, it trains people to know that if they say something good about you, they'll get retweeted.
Bing,
and
bing,
then
bing.
They want to get retweeted by you, so they say more good things about you, which sees it builds on itself. How dare she? That's disgusting. furious. And I like Sarah Silverman, but can I swear?
Yeah, sure.
That's bullshit, right?
There are people that don't know, that have no idea how they got their platform, that don't appreciate how they got their platform, and then go, well, you know, and there are two sides to that too, but it is certainly frustrating to be like, oh, why do you do this? Like, well, you know, you're she's a very talented person,
but she's already been successful, so she doesn't
and it's like,
do that stuff.
Yeah, you know,
but
what? If I'm going to be on Jimmy Kimmel next week, maybe I won't need to do that as much, yeah. You know? Although I don't ever know if I ever
or
actually
on
retweet.
Jimmy Kimmel for several years.
Here's one
of the aspects that I think is too important to remember is psychologically, there's a few psychological backdoors that we all fall for. One of the most powerful of them is the idea of social proof. Social proof is I define what I'm doing as normal or not normal by the actions of other people and the approval thereof. So it's why we have Yelp reviews. We feel safe going to a restaurant because 1,000 people have voted it at 4.5 stars. Same thing with Amazon reviews. It's the reason that McDonald's lists billions and billions served, because you think, well, maybe if it's bad, at least I'm not the only one making a bad decision today. And it is a powerful force. And I don't see in today's 21st century, if you're an upcoming artist or entrepreneur, I see it being as irresponsible to not take responsibility for helping to sculpt your own social proof around your product.
Yeah, I mean, and everybody has their own mission. Like, I don't know that I like retweet compliments because I'm still.
I retweet every compliment at Aubrey Sitterson. Well, every single compliment. Give them to me right now. As soon as the show is over, I'm going to retweet every single compliment I find. Yeah, there it is. Every single one.
A U B R E Y S I T T E R S O N.
Every compliment.
Maybe I will if I get some, and then I will. It's interesting. But on the other side, I get an email. I had a tweet like, "Hey, I need your agent." And I go look at this person's tweet thing, and it's like, "Hey, Brian Grazer, read my script," or "Hey, read my Bible." He's asking everybody, and it's like, "All right, dude.
Yeah,
you're gonna make it onto the do not go list. You know, you're, and it's this. Hey, I'm ambitious. I'm pushing. It's like, all right, I'm not gonna be this person like, oh, you know, work hard like everybody else did or whatever. Like, no. But
by the way, By the way, as if on cue, just this second during this conversation, the great podcasting legend Dan Carlin, whose Hardcore History and Common Sense podcast are the closest thing I can think of to the extemporaneous speaking style of Scald, just retweeted somebody randomly shouting, "Listening to my favorite podcast, Hardcore History. Check out this great podcast," with a link to it and everything. And if it's good enough for Dan Carlin, it's good enough for me.
Yeah, some weirdo just complimented me on Twitter too, and I retweeted it. But I don't know. Yeah, that's a weird photo. But no, here's the other thing too: I used to really revel in just mixing up and just being like, just being clever and going back and forth with people and rat-a-tat-tat on the internet. And I had, especially during like wrestling shows. And so I'm not going to get deep in wrestling stuff. Although I know Justin would love it. But I had like a GIF. Or not, it wasn't even a GIF. It was just an image of like a hand jerk off motion, right? And whenever anybody said anything just profoundly stupid and awful, I would retweet it with that. Like when they were like yelling at me or telling me how awful I was. But then one time I went to my Twitter page and I looked at it and it was nothing but hand jerk off symbols and then people insulting me and saying how awful I am. And I looked at it, I'm like, you know what? This isn't good branding. This isn't real good for the Aubrey Citizen brand. And that's exactly what it is, man. If somebody goes to my Twitter page, I want them to see people talk about how amazing I am. And so of course I'm going to retweet people.
I don't have a single negative exchange with anybody. And I had like 2 weeks ago, somebody asked me about –
just watching wrestling. You'll have nothing but negative exchanges.
No. I have people who say negative stuff to me. But I don't – you don't get that response from me. You know, I won't, you know, be like, oh, you're an idiot or whatever. Like, all right. Anyhow, I've had people like ask me about religion. I'm like, well, I don't think there's a God, but there's this point of view and da-da-da-da. I never go negative. But you can call me anything in the world. I'm not going to respond. I'm not going to point out the grammar or whatever. I'm not going to make fun. I just don't do that because I'm a very different brand than somebody talking about wrestling, to be sure. But I just – I will not – you can call me anything you want in the world. And even if I have a sarcastic response, I will not use it on Twitter because my brand is you look through there and the controlled – version of me is a very nice, even-keeled guy. You know, the person talking about Mars, you know, when you know, space elevators here. Oh,
yeah. No, I think, but part of it, I mean, there is an art. You know, I think that there isn't a way to do it. You know, in terms of getting the word out for yourself and retweeting compliments. I think that there's a like in anything, a optimum time and a place. To do it. But, you know, when it comes to, I don't know. I mean, for me, I always found that whenever anybody said something lousy about me, the best way to kind of short circuit it is to jump behind them and yell louder about what they're saying about me. It's just like, it tends to take the fun out when they're like, I had somebody, cause I constantly have typos in my tweets and you know, so somebody wrote to me, when will you tweet something that we can actually read? And why don't you write anything that we can actually read, something like that? And it was just like, I don't know, my public school education, I guess. Like, you know, it's probably.
And you know what? The stuff for like the little zings like that, you know what I do with that?
Yeah.
I star it or heart it. It's like, because that's my way of saying,
you got me.
I read what you had to say.
I'm a big fan of.
And listen, it there is. Even for us as creative professionals that put the word out on our own stuff and work really, really, really hard, this is not necessarily the journey as for, white guys doing things that necessarily happens for women or people of color and stuff like that. Like it definitely can be a bit of a minefield in a more personal, weird place than just people reacting positively or negatively to your work or who your persona is. But
I don't think that I've ever experienced the vitriol and some of the other stuff that a lot of people who are talking about dealing with more controversial stuff or whatever. And
I got violent threats when I worked on a wrestling video game pretty regularly.
Wow.
Pretty regularly. Yeah.
Oh, that's – yeah. I mean, well, come on. Like, oh, you're going to
– yeah, that's like imagine that Venn diagram of like hardcore wrestling fans and hardcore video game fans. It's a nasty middle section.
No, that is Mordor right there. That is the land of wind and ghosts.
Yeah. So don't be afraid to promote within reason. Be mindful, but – you know, they're listening to old media people tell you how you're supposed to do it, or people who have, you know, people have platform. It's funny because we've talked about this before about, you know, Louis C.K. is an amazing, hardworking comedian who's done amazing stuff. But, you know, when he goes off and he does his comedy album, you know, comedy video and releases it on his own, this is a guy that's worked for the biggest, you know, giants in the business who've helped him build this platform because he's got great content, but he's had multiple TV shows. He's a guy that can walk on the Tonight Show. He's a guy that can do this stuff. Yeah, of course, he can go do a really top-selling video download thing, which guess what? People were doing that 10 years before, but it's great to see somebody like that. This was, what, 4 years ago when he did that? You know, embracing and legitimizing the system, but often people are judging you by where – you know, people who have totally different platforms, you know.
Absolutely. So. Hey, real quick on picks, if you liked the idea of the value of social proof, read Robert Cialdini's classic book, Influence. That's one of the whole section about that and what he's able to convince people into doing based on social proof.
That's a great book, The Psychology of Persuasion.
My pick is Aubrey's other podcast, Straight Shoot. I'm on it this week. It is a if you are into wrestling and you listen to wrestling podcasts and you're like, man, 90% of this wrestling podcast is people bitching about wrestling. And it just sounds like, you know, a constant audiobook of somebody's suicide note to their interest in professional wrestling. Then you will love Straight Shoot. Aubrey is very, very smart. He obviously has top-notch taste in guests, and it is always about what is interesting and enjoyable and looking forward about the art of professional wrestling, as opposed to just constantly bitching about plot holes and your anger about, you know, some backstage stuff that you probably don't even really know the full story on.
Hey, and I'll say this too, man. This past week's episode that you were on, you came on and talked about Hood Slam, which is an independent wrestling promotion near you. And I have, like, I don't know if you're getting kickbacks from Hood Slam or not, but you should be, because I have gotten, like, so many of my listeners have messaged me or emailed me or left comments saying that they are completely sold on Hood Slam and want to travel to the Bay Area. Or if they're already there, go to the next one, definitely. So you're doing God's work, Justin.
Find me at ringside. Buy me a beer. It gets a little thick crowd-wise, so I'm going to need somebody to just shuffle me a beer mid-card there.
Last week my pick was Vellum, and I'm just going to touch upon it again. That's if you want to do ebook creation software. And now that I've actually released an ebook using Vellum, you can check out my book, Game Night, which it's, if you buy, you have to pay when you put out a book. You pay them a flat fee though. It works great. If you want to see what the book looks like, but you don't want to send me 99 cents or send Amazon 99 cents, just email me and I will send you the Kindle version of that. I'm happy to let you look at it. If any of you listening to this podcast right now, if you're thinking about, oh, well, how will this look on my Kindle or whatever, I'll send you the version for free just so you can take a look. My pick is actually I've been using this a lot, and not a whole lot, but obviously to check my ebooks and stuff. Is I have the Amazon Fire tablet. Now understand, I've got an iPad mini. I've got an iPad Air 2. I'm probably going to get myself an iPad Pro once the Pencil comes into stock. The Kindle Fire tablet, it's a $50 tablet. It is not compared to a really nice iPad or compared to a really nice, you know, Android tablet. But for 50 bucks, you've got a great little device that lets you watch Amazon Prime movies, that you can watch other content that's on there. I think Audible supports on it, and you can read ebooks. You can read Kindle ebooks. It's 50 bucks just to buy this little dinky thing. And I get a lot of people like, I don't have a reader. I read on my phone or whatever. If you want a larger screen, get this. It's not, the screen is not great. I'm doing a hell of a sales job here, I know. The screen is not as good as a really good phone now is with as far as pixel density, but it's big and it's easy to read ebooks on it. And so for 50 bucks, having one of these little things laying around or whatever, be able to read, it's good. You can just shut it off and leave it there. It's got a pretty good power save function. And, you know, there's so much cool stuff content out there. And, you know, you don't want to have to necessarily worry about, oh, where did I leave my iPad or whatever? It's 50 bucks.
It's a $50 tablet that works like a $60 tablet.
At least.
$59.99. Let's not get too out of the way here. But it's amazing what you can get for, you know, 50 bucks now. And I have, because I just sent my ebook out and people are like, I don't have a Kindle. Well, the software's free. You can work on anything you have. And if you really just want a reading device and you don't want to spend 100 bucks for the Paperwhite, a $50 tablet is fine, and it's plugged into the Amazon ecosystem, and you have everything there. So, just a thought.
Right, that sounds like a hell of a deal. It is amazing how cheap these things have gotten, though. It is absolutely crazy, and the functionality of, like, you know, a lot of people have Prime now, especially if you have Prime, the value that you get out of that device just skyrockets, right? Even if just like if you carry that, throw that in your bag, right? And your mm-hmm. iPad dies and you can still watch, you know, whatever Amazon show or movie that you want, you know, just as like an extra thing with an extra battery. It's super rad.
It's funny. These things are so cheap. They sell them in six packs. You can buy six for the price of five.
Dude,
and it's cheaper than an iPad.
I mean, to be honest, if I did not have a tablet as a family of five, that would be a slam dunk. Everybody gets Fires. Way.
Yeah, I'm using it all the time to check formatting and stuff on my ebooks. I'm like, oh, I'll just pop this up and see how it looks there. And like, oh, okay, this is what it looks like, and pop back there. And, you know, I've not tried to read anything at length on that screen, but it's not, you know, see, it's all blown out, but.
Well, there we go. Amazon.
Right on. Guys.
It's been After Fleck.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.